Okay, so now we can move on with the suttas. Before I start, I just wanted to ask if was anyone very disturbed by what happened yesterday, or was everyone okay with that? Does anyone need to talk about it or anything? Is everyone fine? Because if everyone is fine, we'll just let it be as it is. But if someone wants to talk about it, we can have a short meeting or something afterwards. Is everyone okay?
Again,
yeah.
Someone asked me at the breakfast table. I said there might be a.
Okay.
I said. All right. There could be okay. Some announcement. After.
Okay. So what we will do then? We will have after the. If someone wants to have a chat about it, whatever, then Lehar will have a short meeting afterwards. After the suttas, and so at 9 o'clock or whatever, and we can have a talk about it if you like. But I won't be here. I will just go back. But Lehar will facilitate that. So those people who are not interested in having a meeting, you can just go back to your room or whatever. And those who want to stay behind, you can stay behind. All right. So let's get into the suttas. So as I mentioned yesterday, so far we have been looking at the idea of right view and how to kind of think about the world from the Buddha's perspective, how to look at life, and then to how that enables the spiritual path from having right view, because you understand what is truly valuable in life. You get your values right. Once you have your values in the right place, in accordance with reality, in accordance with how things actually are, in accordance with the way the world works, then of course your priorities change, and your where you put in your effort and what you do in your life all kind of aligns with that, the way the world actually is, rather than with a delusion or a misunderstanding and these things. So then once your values are kind of in the right place, then of course the practice of the path begins. And a large part of that practice, the Noble Eightfold Path, is then first of all, the right intention, which comes directly out of the right view. In other words, your goals, etc., become, again, aligned with what works and the way things are. And then the beginning of that path, after you have the right aim, the right goals, is that you practice morality. Morality being such an important part of the Buddhist path. And then further down, as the Noble Eightfold Path unfolds, you have this thing called right effort. And right effort is about purifying the mind and meditation practice and all of these kind of things. And that's where we want to pick up things again with the right effort. How we deal with the mind specifically, and how we develop from there, and then going on to meditation as we go along. And the next sutta we're going to look at is called the Fear and Dread Sutta, the Baya Bhairava Sutta. And again, it's another of these autobiographical accounts of the Buddha, the Buddha-to-be, I should say, and what he was doing to kind of reach awakening. And as we shall see, the idea again is to motivate us to practice and follow the example of the Buddha to be here. So let's see what the Buddha has to say. So this is found again in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle-length sayings of the Buddha. It's the fourth sutta, and you can check it out yourself if you like it. But the most of the sutta is actually here. There's a little bit towards the end that is missing here, but this is a large part of that particular sutta. So I have heard. At one time the Buddha was staying near Savatthi in Jeta's grove, Anathapindika's monastery. Then the Brahmin Jansoni went up to the Buddha and exchanged greetings with him. When the greetings and polite conversation were over, he sat down to one side and said to the Buddha, "Master Gotama, those gentlemen who have gone forth from the lay life to homelessness out of faith in Master Gotama, have Master Gotama to lead the way, to help them out, and to give them encouragement. And those people follow Master Gotama's example." So here we have one of these Brahmins, The Brahmins were in those days a very kind of important part of society, because they were often the educated people, and they were the people who they were kind of on top of the class structure. The Brahmins and the aristocrats were kind of the upper castes in ancient India. And so they would often have very important positions, and they would often be like the advisors to the kings and these sort of things. And this Brahmin Janusoni was one of these advisors. He was an advisor to King Pasenadi of Kosala, Kosala being one of the great kingdoms in ancient India, and King Pasenadi being the king of that large country at that particular time. So this Brahmin Janusoni, he recurs in many, many places in the suttas, and he was obviously considered an important lay disciple of Buddhism, of the Buddha, and he kind of he pops up every here and there and again in the suttas, and here he is again. So after a while you think, you don't think that at all, actually. I don't know. Sometimes it's best not to say what you're about to say and just kind of hold back. You kind of, just in time, you kind of refrain from saying something silly here. So anyway. So then, as you always find in the suttas, he goes up to the Buddha and they exchange greetings. The greetings and polite conversation. And this is a very important thing, that whenever the Buddha meets somebody, there's always some kind of nice conversation, first of all. How are you? Have you had enough to eat? Where have you come from? And these kind of things. And of course, the idea behind this is to make people feel at ease, to feel relaxed, to feel good in the Buddha's company. Because the Buddha, he obviously has a very big reputation already at that time. And people might feel a bit nervous, or a bit sort of, unsure what to do. And then when the Buddha is polite and friendly in this way, people can relax. And so this is part of the idea of right speech. Right speech doesn't mean that you always talk about Dhamma in all circumstances, but it's about being kind and friendly and making people feel at home and feeling at ease in your company. It's a very important part of it. And you can see the Buddha does this all the time. And then when you feel relaxed, when you feel at ease, that is when the Dhamma starts to penetrate. It starts to go in. You have the ability, your mind opens up, your heart opens up, and you're actually able to take these things in as a consequence. And that's why it is sometimes a bit unfortunate when you have like incidents we had yesterday, because it kind of detracts a little bit from the atmosphere, to put it that way. But on the other hand, when you have these kind of incidents, it's also just life happening. This is life, and we need to learn to deal with these things, because life is full of this sort of stuff. Ideally, it doesn't happen when you're on retreat, but it is impossible to avoid these things altogether. Sometimes these things actually do happen. So the idea here is to feel a sense of ease and to kind of be able to deal with it in the right way. And I don't know about you, but when I saw this fellow yesterday, I just felt, you can kind of tell that someone is in real suffering and they're in real trouble. When people react like that, there's some very underlying problems there. And for me, the right reaction when I see that is always a sense of compassion, because you know that here is someone who is really suffering and they're going through a hard time. And when you have that sense of compassion for someone who is difficult, it kind of neutralizes the whole thing, and it's not really an issue anymore. And that, I think, is very often the kind of the right approach in these sort of circumstances. And so it is about feeling at ease in all of these cases, and then the Dhamma tends to flow much more easily, and you can take things on board, and meditation works, everything kind of comes together as a consequence. So, and then this Brahmin says to the Buddha, he says that those gentlemen who have gone forth out of faith in the Master Gautama, and of course, the idea out of faith or confidence is the critical word here. This is the right way to go forth, a sense of confidence in these teachings, that they actually do what they are supposed to do. So those who go out of forth, well, they have Master Gautama to lead the way, to help them out, to give them encouragement. This is the purpose of the Buddha, is to kind of point the direction, right? And that is what the Buddha does. And the Buddha does not make the path happen for you. You are responsible for your own practice. In Buddhism, faith and confidence is important, but it's only a means to something larger. It's a means to actually doing the practice. And so in Buddhism, you know, in the end, you have to take responsibility for yourself. And this is what makes Buddhism a bit scary, but also empowering at the same time, because you are empowered, and it's up to you to make something out of this. And this is kind of, to me, the great thing about Buddhism. It's in the end, it is down to you to ensure that something comes out of this. And then it has this nice saying here that those people follow Master Gotama's example. And this is what I've been saying all along, that when we practice, we read the autobiography of the Buddha to be, or the Buddha, and we see how the Buddha practiced, and actually we should follow the way the Buddha practiced. And this is, of course, very interesting and very important, because, again, it shows us that there is no fundamental distinction between the Buddha and us, or the Buddha-to-be and us. It is the same. We have the same problems, the same humanity, exactly the same path. And if we are to follow the Buddha's example, it means that the Buddha also practiced the Noble Eightfold Path. Whether he didn't really know that he was practicing that. For the Buddha, it was a bit random, because he didn't have a teacher, he didn't have a clear path. But he did not practice the paramis. He did not practice the bodhisattva path. He practiced the same thing. Otherwise, he wouldn't follow his example. Following the Buddha's example does not mean that you take a vow and you're going to, you know, practice for four incalculable eons and then become a Buddha down the track. That is not what it means. What it means in the suttas is always the Noble Eightfold Path, because that is the only path that is explained in the suttas. And so the Buddha must also have practiced that path. And this is kind of comes out of this. The Buddha did not practice some mythological, legendary path that is never spoken about in the suttas, but which in later Buddhism has become a very important way of presenting Buddhism. But actually, the Buddha never presented it that way. So we follow the example of the Buddha. So when you hear these suttas, they should inspire us to live and practice in the same way. And this is kind of the idea here. And then the Buddha says, "That's so true, Brahman. Everything you say is true." And then he, Janusoni, says further. He says, "But Master Gotama, remote lodgings in the wilderness and the forest are challenging. It is hard to maintain seclusion and hard to find joy in solitude. The forest seems to rob the mind of a mendicant who isn't stilled in meditation or stilled in samadhi." So this is the idea that solitude and seclusion can be hard. And it's hard to find joy in that solitude. And this is kind of the challenge. And if you're not ready, the forest can rob the mind. The idea, you can go crazy if you're not ready. You can go a bit unhinged if you have too much solitude and you're not ready for that solitude. I mean, it's not going to happen here because we have lots of people around us. But if you live like in a little hut in the forest by yourself and you don't see anyone for weeks on end, then if your mind isn't ready, and the mind is kind of, it can get unbalanced quite easily. And the reason is simply that if there are some underlying defilements in the mind, desires, or maybe some ill will, and there's no way that you can satisfy those, and there's no outlet for that ill will or whatever, it all becomes bottled up inside, and then all kinds of delusions and all kinds of problems arise as a consequence of that. And the mind really goes unhinged after a while. And this is a common problem. And so really the way to practice in the right way is to attain the samadhi, the stillness of the mind, first of all. And when you have a degree of stillness, well, then you actually are ready for solitude proper. In the meantime, you have to have kind of halfway houses. Yeah, you have a degree of solitude, but not complete solitude. And you kind of find out the right balance for yourself. That balance will vary from person to person. Coming here to Jhana Grove is a good kind of halfway house for many people. Gives an opportunity to meditate, and a lot of people have really good results in the meditation while they're here. It's, you know, we're kind of on the right track, so to speak. This is his question. Yeah, how can you find that joy in solitude? This is what he is wondering about. And then the Buddha responds again, that is so true, Brahman. Everything you say is true. And then the Buddha goes on to talk about his own dwelling in the forest and how he actually went about this and how he was able to enjoy that solitude. So again, before my awakening, when I was still unawakened but intent on awakening, I too thought remote lodgings in the wilderness and the forest are challenging. It is hard to maintain solitude or seclusion and hard to find joy in solitude. The forests seem to rob the mind of a mendicant who isn't stilled in samadhi. Again, it's interesting here that even the Buddha-to-be, despite his spiritual qualities, even he was kind of a bit concerned about solitude, seeing the danger in this. Of course, what that means is that we should all be very careful. If the Buddha-to-be thought this might be dangerous, then everyone should really be a bit on the outlook. It shouldn't be too have too much hubris and think that, yeah, I can deal with this easily. And then you end up completely nuts down the track. That is not really a good outcome at all. Being careful about solitude is the right way. And kind of doing things in a gradual way and knowing whether you are, you know, going down the wrong track or not. Monitoring yourself and seeing what happens in your mind, etc. So even the Buddha was concerned about this. And of course, then the Buddha wants to find the solution so that he actually can have that solitude. Then I thought, there are ascetics and Brahmins who are unpurified, conduct of body, speech, and mind, who frequent remote lodgings in the wilderness and the forest. Those ascetics and Brahmins summon unskillful fear and dread because of their defects in their conduct. But I don't frequent remote lodgings in the wilderness and the forest with unpurified conduct of body, speech, and mind. My conduct is purified. I'm one of those noble ones who frequent remote lodgings in the wilderness and the forest with purified conduct of body, speech, and mind. Seeing this purity of conduct in myself, I felt even more unruffled about staying in the forest. If you have unpurified conduct by body, speech, and mind, that is when you can kind of expect fear when you go into the forest. This is kind of interesting. When you have that, then you will summon, it says, summon unskillful. In other words, you will experience unskillful fear and dread. Why is it that when you are unpurified in conduct, why is it that you feel fearful? What is the reason for that? I think the obvious reason is that the way we act on the world is how we experience the world acting on us. So if we act in the world in unskillful ways, if we speak bad ways, we do bad actions, we think about things in a certain way, we tend to feel that the world will act in the same way back to us. Because I think this is a natural human thing, that we tend to think that the rest of the world is roughly the way we are. We think everyone else is basically the same as we are. The way we perceive the world, we think other people perceive the world in the same way. And that is why we're sometimes so surprised when other people see the world completely differently. And we think, can't you see? It's obvious, right? This is how it feels very often. It feels like it's bleeding obvious to me, so how come you can't see it that way? Well, this is precisely the point, is that people actually are quite different. And the way that the world is often got nothing to do with the way we think things are. People look at things in very different ways. And so if you are unpurified in body, speech, and mind, you tend to view the world around you as also unpurified. And so if you have a degree of ill will, you see the world as having ill will. If you have a lot of desires, you see desires in other people. We see what we have. We see that in others. And so when you have these unwholesome states of mind, and you feel that the world around you has similar kind of unwholesome states, and of course you're going to be fearful, because you know that these things will lead to problems, and they will lead to the world maybe being dangerous for you. But if you are really purified, and all you have is loving kindness for the world and compassion for the world, and you have renounced things in your life, then you tend to see the world in a very benevolent way. You feel that the world will react back to you in a similar kind of way. And this is one of those beautiful things about having, developing loving kindness and compassion. You start to feel really safe. It is as if the world can't touch you anymore. This is one of those beautiful consequences. And so when you have a very high degree of purity of mind, you feel, the world feels safe. Whether the world is safe or not, that's how it feels to you. It feels safe. And you never have any fear in any kind of circumstance. This is kind of one of the beautiful effects of or consequences of having this powerful metta and compassion in your life. So it's really worthwhile developing. Kindness towards others means that the world reflects that back to you, and you feel the kindness of the world. You see that kindness around you when you're there. And when someone behaves in a strange way, all you really do is you have compassion for them, because you kind of see the delusion or the problem there. So this is one of the many, many great consequences of living well, is a feeling that the world is a safe place. It's also strange, if you have a lot of metta and compassion, you are no longer afraid of dying, for example. It's as if there is an intuition inside of you that nothing can really go wrong. Even if you die, okay, you're going to be okay. It's not really an issue. So death itself becomes a non-issue when you have a lot of goodwill towards the world around you. And that's kind of nice. If you're not afraid of dying, then who can possibly scare you? No one can scare you anymore. Because if dying is kind of considered the worst thing that can happen, if that is not a problem, then it's okay. This is how the simile of the saw, how that becomes possible. Many of you will know the very famous simile of the saw. It's found in the Majjhima Nikaya 21, the Kakkatrupama Sutta. And the symbol of the saw is basically that even if bandits pin you to the ground and they have a two-handled saw, or maybe a chainsaw in the present, I don't know what they have, and they cut you limb from limb, kind of cutting off your legs, cutting off your arms. And then the Buddha says, the person who has a sense of ill will towards those bandits that cut you up in this way, that person is not practicing my teaching. Even when someone cuts you up in that way, you're supposed to have loving kindness and compassion for them. And that's interesting, right? It's a very fascinating teaching, because it sounds impossible. But of course it isn't impossible. It isn't impossible because if you have no fear of death, and if you understand that the person who is in trouble is not you, but the person who's cutting you up, they are the ones who are in trouble, because they are the ones that have to reap the consequences of the terrible actions. As for yourself, you will die and you will go off to a nice realm afterwards anyway. No big deal, right? A few moments of pain, and then you're okay again. That is the right way of thinking about this. And of course then the simile of the saw starts to make sense. Even the most dire situations, you can deal with them, and you can have compassion and metta for those people who practice in that way. So that is one of the challenges on the Buddhist path, and this is how it kind of starts out. So then by being purified in body, speech and mind, then you can frequent these remote lodgings in the wilderness, in the forest, because you have no fear, yeah? And then you are even more unruffled about staying in the forest. And then the Buddha goes on, then I thought there are ascetics and Brahmins with unpurified livelihood who frequent remote lodgings in the wilderness and the forest. Those ascetics and Brahmins, they experience unskillful fear and dread because of these defects in their livelihood. But I don't frequent remote lodgings in the wilderness and forest with unpurified livelihood. My livelihood is purified. I'm one of those noble ones who frequent remote lodgings in the wilderness and the forest with purified livelihood. Seeing this purity of livelihood in myself, I felt even more unruffled about staying in the forest. So a livelihood here is, in one sense, it is an aspect of morality, that you live well and you make your living in a way that doesn't harm other beings. That's obviously an important part of this kind of livelihood. But it's also about, if you're going to be a monastic, you have to live your monastic life in the right way, not acting as a doctor, not doing business deal with people. I'm going to read your palms and tell you your future if you give me some nice food later on. That's kind of wrong livelihood from a monastic. A lot of what monastics did at the time of the Buddha, a lot of the wrong livelihood, is precisely about predicting the future. Yeah, reading the stars, reading the tea leaves, reading all kind of things. Yeah, there's a million ways of predicting the future, and many of them are listed in the in some of the suttas. Yeah, and all of them are considered wrong livelihood. And of course, there is a degree of greed there. There's a degree of a business deal. And of course, when there is a business deal, then maybe there is grounds for being unsure. How are people going to treat you? What's going to happen? Etc., etc. But when you purely rely on the gifts of others and you return that by living in the right way, doing the right thing, discussing the Dhamma, there's a very beautiful exchange there, exchanging material things for spiritual things. And this is one of those beautiful things that Buddhism has had all the way from the very beginning until the present day. And it's a very pure way of doing things. No one is forced. There is no business deal. Everyone does it out of their free will rather than actually being forced to do things. We're not selling anything. We are just kind of exchanging something positive. And everyone gains all the way through. And this is kind of the beauty of this. So that purity makes itself felt when you go into solitude, and you can relax more and be more at ease because of that purity in your livelihood. All right. Then the Buddha goes on, and there's all of these wrong ways that are not helpful. Then I thought there are ascetics and Brahmins full of desire for the sensory pleasures of the world, with acute lust for sensual pleasures. But I am not full of desire, and because I'm not full of desire, then I can live in these remote forest lodgings as a consequence. And again, here is this idea, if you're full of desires and you're trying to live in the forest and there is no outlet for those desires, then it ends up just being a mental thing, and it kind of builds up in the mind. And if you can't let go of it, then eventually it will drive you slightly crazy, because these ideas, they kind of just build up and you start hallucinating after a while, and all kind of things happen as a consequence of that. So all of these things, because they are drivers of our behavior, and unless we are able to deal with it somehow, they will form your mind, form your thinking, and they kind of start deluding you in a very bad way. All of these interests that are not really can't be satisfied will always be problematic in this way. So after a while, you start to go funny. So again, you want to be pure mentally as much as you possibly can. There are ascetics and Brahmins full of ill will, with malicious intentions, but I have a heart full of love. So again, if you have lots of anger and malicious intentions within, and there's nowhere for that to go, it builds up inside. Sometimes that turns onto you, and you get angry maybe with yourself, and that's kind of really negative. Or you start to feel the anger in the world around you, and then you start kind of hearing strange noises, and you kind of start to feel the demons in the forest, and all of these things are just built up out of the delusion of ill will, and you see things that aren't really actually there, and it then becomes very, very problematic. You can see why these things will happen. There are ascetics and Brahmins overcome with dullness and drowsiness, but I am free of dullness and drowsiness. Dullness and drowsiness, if you are very common for this to happen when you live in solitude, that you get dull. There's nothing to interest you when you are in solitude. There's nothing really, there's no sensual pleasures to look forward to. And then the mind kind of dulls out because it all seems very kind of pointless and boring and useless. And the mind doesn't want to stay with that suffering that arises from this. And one of the ways of dealing with suffering in the mind is to become dull. This is kind of a very common response to suffering. You become dull. And you're sitting in acuity trying to meditate, but actually all you experience is a kind of low-level suffering. And after a while, the mind just refuses to be with it, and it becomes dull instead. A very common problem in solitude. And that dull mind, because you're not really aware of what is going on, not really able to follow and to be present properly, it starts to imagine things, and it starts to feel things that are not actually there, and it starts to go funny again, and seeing and hearing and experiencing stuff that is gradually leads you astray and leads you into problems. There are ascetics and Brahmins who are restless with no peace of mind, but my mind is peaceful. Mind is running along, not really finding any peace. And again, this is very difficult to bear if you are in solitude, because again, there is no outlet for this. There's nothing you can really do. So it becomes really problematic when there is too much restlessness. So you want to have a peaceful mind, reasonably peaceful anyway, not 100%, but before you actually go into solitude in this way. There are ascetics and Brahmins who are doubting and uncertain, but I have gone beyond doubt. Doubting in the Dhamma usually means doubting what is wholesome, what is unwholesome. Vichikicca. And if you have doubts about what is wholesome and unwholesome, it means you're going to have a hard time directing your mind in the right way. You're going to kind of miss out, and you're going to not be able to still the mind and make it peaceful and achieve samadhi. And this is one of the things we talked about before, the idea that you are practicing and you reach a plateau, and then it doesn't go any further. And you wonder, why is it that it doesn't go any further? Why does my mind stop at this particular point? This is like the doubt, the uncertainty, the lack of knowledge, the lack of really understanding the mind properly. And it can be very hard to see, because you may feel quite peaceful, you may feel that the mind is wholesome compared to what it normally is, but still it hasn't really gone as far as it should go. And then you need to uncover those problems. And if you go in solitude too early, you don't have anyone to ask, you don't have anyone to kind of bounce your ideas off or whatever. It's going to be difficult very often to find a solution to these things, and it's going to be problematic. So you want to ideally go beyond doubt as much as you can before you do this. Having a full understanding of your mind, knowing what the defilements really are, knowing what it means to be attached, knowing the basic causes, why the mind doesn't develop any further. Very often we can use the teachings that you find in the suttas to understand that. The Buddha often says the problem is basically attachment to the world, the five senses. That is kind of the root problem of all of these things. And it may manifest in a number of ways. It can manifest in dullness or restlessness or ill will or many other defilements. We'll have a look at those later on. So all of these things. And then you have a way of finding out about the uncertainties and understanding it before you go into solitude. There are ascetics and Brahmins who glorify themselves and put others down. I don't glorify myself and put others down. So this is like you're trying to kind of build up your ego, I suppose, by thinking of yourself very highly and putting other people down. That kind of works maybe when you are around other people, but when you are in solitude, it might not work so well. And then again, you might just end up becoming really distorted within yourself as you try to do this. And one of the problems of the ego is that the ego always needs to be supported or built up. Yeah, it always needs that. Once you have built up a sense of self that is unrealistic or has nothing to do with reality, then you need to kind of keep it there. Yeah, you become very fragile as a person, very vulnerable, because it's very easy that if that ego gets challenged by your interaction with society or whatever, then you will feel bad because the ego, you start to realize that actually you have a wrong estimation of yourself. And so an ego is a very painful thing. And this is one of the great things about meditation. We are part of what we're doing in meditation is letting go of the ego. And how does that manifest? And the way that it manifests is that you become more peaceful. So much of the ego is expressed through how we think. Yeah, the thinking mind is part of that. I mentioned before, the thinking mind is a result of the interest in the five sense world, but it's also a result of the ego, because the ego needs to defend itself. The ego needs to justify itself, its existence. The ego needs to relate itself to certain things in the world. Yeah, who are you? Your sense of identity is also part of that ego. And your sense of identity is about your reputation, about where you come from, your background, all of these kind of things. And sometimes the sense of self wants to think about these things to stabilize that sense of self inside. And in the suttas, you find this. You find that the way to refine the mind, you start with the coarse kind of defilements and hindrances, and you refine it from that. Then you have the middling defilements and hindrances. And then the most refined hindrances to meditation is often the mind that has an interest in the sense of self, your identity, in a sense. It's one of some of the most refined aspects of the mind. So it's good to overcome that a little bit and starting, instead of identifying with all of these worldly things, instead to identify with those spiritual qualities inside of you. And this is kind of what happens down the path, changing your identity, identifying with new things. You don't have a choice. You have to identify with something, because the sense of self is going to be there for a long time going on the path. So what we have to do is we have to skillfully choose a kind of new identity for ourselves. And as you meditate, as your meditation gets better, you actually almost automatically start to identify with those new stages of meditation that you achieve. And the reason why you identify with those is because they are very beautiful, they're very delightful. And of course, we want to identify with feeling good, with positive feelings, with a sense of metta and compassion. It is natural for us to identify with that. And it happens almost as a matter of course. And as you do that, you can let go of some of the coarser kind of identity. I am educated, or I am from such and such a country, or I am whatever it is that you identify with. All of that starts to become silly. And you start to identify with these beautiful qualities inside. And there's a lot of very positive things that comes out of that, because those qualities that you develop within, the compassion, the metta, the kindness, all of these things, these are universal qualities. Yeah, these are qualities that everyone can develop. And in a sense, it helps you to go beyond all of the superficial identity that leads to conflict in the world. If you identify as a certain nationality, right, I'm Australian or I'm whatever, then there is always going to be a potential for conflict for those people who are not Australian because I'm proud of being Australian. I remember I was always, when I first came to Australia, it's a long time ago now, but almost 30 years ago, I saw these kind of products made in Australia, and it said proudly made in Australia, and I thought, what is this all about, this kind of, so, and that of course, proudly made in Australia, that is the identification with being Australian, right? We are proud of what this country is doing, and it's okay to be proud of that, as long as you don't set it up against other countries. That is where the problem arises, and that is where conflict arises. The more we give up of this superficial sense of self, the more integrated we become with other people, the more accepting we become of differences in the world, because we're seeing deeper into the human mind. We're seeing the universal characteristics rather than seeing those things that differentiate each other from each other. And of course, when you do that, when you see the universal characteristics in that way, and you don't have the potential for conflict, of course, you feel at ease in the forest. Yeah, because everyone is like your friend. Yeah, the ghosts, please come. Yeah, you have ghosts as your friend. If there are no human beings around, you can take the ghosts as your friends instead. And you hang out with the ghosts. And the ghosts are probably happy that there is finally a human being who isn't afraid of them, yeah? And they're really pleased with that, because usually human beings, they run a mile when they see a ghost. But here is a human being who has compassion for the ghosts. So that's what we should kind of aim for, having compassion for the ghosts. And then you are going to be okay in the forest. So you don't glorify yourself and put others down. You let go of all of these superficial ideas that have to do with identity. And you go into the deeper aspects within, whereby that differentiation kind of stops. There are, I said, things in Brahmins who are cowardly and craven, but I don't get startled. Here the idea is that I guess you are at ease with things. You don't get startled by things, and you kind of just go with the flow of things without really being afraid or something like that. Not sure exactly what is meant by this, but something like that, I guess, is what the point is. Ascetics and Brahmins who enjoy possessions, honor, and popularity, but I have few wishes. And again, this has to do with your sense of identity to some point. You want to be popular, you want to have honor, etc. In other words, you feed on how other people treat you, and you want to be praised. Yeah, this is so common in the world, we're seeking the praise of others. Even though other people have no idea what they're talking about, still we seek their praise. Isn't that true? It's kind of weird. We are happy when someone praises, even though what does that person know about what is really worthwhile? Actually, they haven't got a clue, right? Actually, we should never really, when someone praises us, actually it means nothing. And very often when people blame us, it also means nothing. Because other people blame us and praise us for the most silly, superficial reasons. Actually shrug your shoulders. If the Buddha praises you, okay, then you have a good reason to feel a bit satisfied. But again, then you feel a kind of quiet satisfaction within you. But you don't really allow your ego to grow because of that. And people like the Buddha, he doesn't really praise you very much. Someone like Ajahn Brahm, does he praise you? No, Ajahn Brahm is just kind to you. He just kind of you have a feeling of someone who is who cares and who does the right thing. But he doesn't necessarily praise you all that much. And one of the reasons is because praise and blame is also a tool for controlling people. People use praise and blame to control. And you can see how easily we get controlled by other people's praise and blame. Thank you for praising me. Then straight away that means that you are under the control of that person because of that. But most of the time people praise you for things that are not worthwhile. If people praise you for being kind, That is what people should praise you for. But very rarely do they praise you for that. If people praise you for kind of living in a good way and being generous, okay, then it is good. But you don't really need praise for that because you know that it feels good. You know it is already right. And sometimes the praise just detracts from that happy feeling that you know that you're living in the right way anyway. Because the praise has a tendency to infect the ego and the sense of self, and then it becomes problematic. So praise and blame are problematic. We should really let go of those things. Instead, we should just have this quiet feeling inside that we know that we're living in the right way. That is far more powerful than all of these superficial things in life. Popularity, right? Popularity is a real hassle. Who wants to be popular? You get all of these people hanging around with you. You can't be in solitude, right? Because you're so popular. And the Buddha, the Buddha was really popular, but he didn't want that. He said, all of these people, may they disappear. I don't want to have anything to do with them. Why are they coming to see me? The Buddha's attendant said, they're coming to see you because now you become famous. You're well known in the world. And the Buddha says, this popularity is like dung. Dung happiness to be popular. Being popular is really bad because it means you can't enjoy the higher kind of happiness. Popularity is not kind of good. From a Buddhist point of view. And so we should really forget about being popular. We should be popular, or we should be, we should kind of have good relationship with others to the extent that we are kind to other people. But it's not a popularity contest. It's not about having the most people who like you, anything like that. It's completely irrelevant. But what is interesting, and this is in the suttas, they actually tell you also, this is kind of like in contrast to this, there are suttas that talk about how to become popular. which seems weird, right? What the suttas talk about is the basis for gathering a group. How do you kind of get the group around you? How do you get people to sort of, be with you? And these are called the Sangaha Vattu. Sangaha means to kind of bring people together, and Vattu is a basis for bringing people together. And there's four of these Sangaha Vattus, in other words, how you get it's like almost how to get an entourage, right? How to people follow you around. And in the suttas, there were these people who always had an entourage with them, right? They were there, and there was always 500 people coming with them whenever they went. And they had practiced these Sangaha Vattus, and that's why they kind of had that, had all these people around. And the four Sangaha Vattus are generosity, they are doing kind of acts of kind acts towards others, helping them out or whatever. Generosity, doing kind acts, speaking, speech that is a kind of endearing to others. You are endearing in the way you speak to them. And the last one is treating everyone equally. These are the four Sangaha Vattus. And if you practice those over a long period of time, eventually you have 500 people following you everywhere. You can see why that is a hassle. 500 people following everywhere. It's a little bit too much. You can see why that might be problematic. It's interesting. You look in the world and you see that there are people like that. They kind of people, they are like magnets for people. And kind of people just flock to them somehow because they have these qualities that are very attractive and people just follow them along. And it's kind of fascinating. I have seen people like that in from lay life as well, people who kind of have this effect on other people. And it's kind of extraordinary when you see that. And of course, the Buddha was probably foremost in these things, but it can happen to anyone. And sometimes it becomes a hassle. But then it is good. If you treat people well and they follow you along because of that, it's fine. But when it becomes a popularity contest and you want to be popular, that is where the problem really arises. So the beautiful thing about these people in the suttas, they would then go to the Buddha, and all of these people would follow along, right? And they got to hear the Dhamma because they had chosen a good friend, a real Kalyanamitta, who brings them on the right track. So you enjoy possessions, honor, and popularity, and that is not a good idea if you want to live in solitude. You want to have few wishes and not want these kind of things. Being honored, right? Being honored by others, again, is kind of irrelevant what other people do and think, because they don't really know anyway, yeah? And so it doesn't really matter here. There are ascetics and Brahmins who are lazy and lacking in energy, but I am energetic. So if you want to enjoy yourself in the forest, in the secluded lodgings, you want to have the energy of the mind, because the energy of the mind is what allows meditation to happen. If the mind is flat, if the mind doesn't really have, if the mind is kind of lazy and doesn't really want to do anything, then there's no way you're going to be able to enjoy the meditation practice. All of these things are qualities that come together. So these are some of the things that you will notice in yourself when your meditation works. There are certain qualities that tend to be developed, and one of them is energy. It's a very important aspect of the meditation practice. Mindfulness, joy, peace, energy. Energy is one of those things. I always remember when Ajahn Brahm was talking about his meditation experiences, he was always saying that sometimes you come out of your meditation and you feel like a nuclear reactor. I don't know how he knows, but it feels like to be a nuclear reactor, but that's what he said, And I thought that was kind of cool. You have a nuclear reactor. You have so much energy. It's like you're bursting with energy. Of course, the difference, the important point here is that that energy is a peaceful kind of energy. It is an energy that is not restless. Most of the energy people have in the world is restless. It always drives you on. But this is an energy which is still and within. It is the power of the mind. And this kind of power is very, very useful, especially if you want to have insight down the track. Because it allows the mind to look. It allows the mind to... it has enough energy to keep on going and keep on looking and understanding things properly. So energy is one of the, in fact, one of the awakening factors. The 7 factors of awakening, one of them is energy. Virya is the Pali word. It's important not to confuse energy with effort, because effort is applying yourself. Energy is a natural quality of the mind. It can result from effort if you apply the effort well, but it's not the same as effort. It is a quality of the mind. And this is what you want to have here when you go into the forest, because that energy will then help you to achieve the meditation and to live in this particular way. Okay. There are ascetics and Brahmins who are unmindful and lacking in situational awareness. I am mindful. You want to be mindful, because if you're not mindful, it basically means that your mind is all over the place and you're not really in charge of yourself. And the idea here is to be in charge of yourself, a feeling that you are in control rather than defilements being in control. There is one of the ways that mindfulness is described in the suttas. It's described as sati adipateya. Adipateya means like that you are in charge, that you have the power. There's the sati, the mindfulness, is a power in your mind. You are in charge, you are in control. And this is kind of the idea of mindfulness. And then you have an even higher kind of power, which is samadhi. The mind is kind of controlled by samadhi. Samadhi rules the mind. These are the rulers. That's a good word. The rulers of the mind. So mindfulness rules the mind. That is why it is so powerful. And what that means, that the mindfulness rules the mind, it means that if there are defilements, if there are things that are happening, you have the ability to deal with it when it starts to arise. Yeah, because you are aware, you are with what's happening. You are clear about what's going on in your mind. You see that now the mind is leaning in such a direction that desire is about to arise, ill will is about to arise, and then you can take an alternative path because of that. Yeah, so you have the, this is the, mindfulness is the ruler of the mind. That's why it is so important. And especially in solitude, you can see why this is the case. It allows you to direct the mind wherever you are. And this is why sometimes we talk about, when we talk about mindfulness of breathing, yeah, this is the number one meditation practice in Buddhism. You see it everywhere in the suttas. And the point I was making at the very beginning of this retreat is that when the Buddha talks about mindfulness of breathing, he always says, you establish mindfulness first. Satting parimukkang upatapetva. Upatapetva means to establish. Satting is mindfulness. Parimukkang is a very, is a word that is very discussed what exactly it means, but a nice translation is just in front of you, yeah, in the present time, the present space, here and now, not some kind of recollection about the past. Having established mindfulness in front of you, then you breathe in, then you breathe out. First of all, sati. And the reason is because sati is the ruler of the mind. It means that you will be able to be with the breath. Not able to focus on the breath, but be able to be with the breath. There's this difference again between focusing, being aware of, placing your mind on, that is one thing which always has a degree of effort to it, and being with, which this is what really, what this is about. Because if you are mindful already, and the breath, of course, is always going to be there, because otherwise you wouldn't be here. So if the, either it's both of you, the breath and you, or it's neither of you, kind of, that's how it works. And so you are there already. You are mindful, the breath is there, and so you are doing mindfulness of breathing simply by being with the breath. It's a very nice way of thinking about it. But always establish mindfulness first, because that gives you this rulership over the mind. Mindfulness rules the mind. And so this, again, why it is so useful in solitude. And then you have the situational awareness. And this is sampajanya in the suttas. Situational awareness is really just about knowing what is appropriate at any particular time. That is why it's called situational awareness, because depending on the situation, you have to act in a certain way. And so the Buddha says that you talk when you talk, you have clear awareness, or you have situational awareness about talking. In other words, you know why you talk. You talk in a way that accords with the Dhamma. You don't talk too long, you don't talk too short. You talk the right thing. In other words, you talk in a way that encourages the practice of the path, that keeps on developing the path. And in everything you do, you have that situational awareness. In how you eat, you eat the right amount. When you come here on retreat, you eat, you enjoy your food, but you also know when to stop. You're not too afraid that you're going to, in the evening, what's going to happen in the evening? There's no dinner this evening and there's nothing more to eat. I better eat a lot. And then you regret that afterwards because you just ate too much. And people think like this, and maybe some of you have thought about that as well. I know people who think precisely like, I'm really afraid at lunch that I might get hungry in the evening. And I can understand that. And I recognize that for many of you, it is going to be quite difficult because you're used to having a meal. As a monk, after a while, you don't even think about it anymore. Even the idea of having dinner is kind of almost disgusting almost, when you've been a monk for so long, because it's just completely gone out of the window. It would never even occur to you. But for lay people, it is hard. So it is not so surprising. But after a while, you learn how to deal with that. You have the situational awareness. You know the right amount. You know the when to be silent, when to speak. All of these kind of things is part of this idea of situational awareness. You know how to lead your entire life, all the little things, in a way that accords with the Dhamma. So everything you do helps you on the path and moves you in the right direction. And then you are on the right track, as they say. Well, do they say that? I'm not sure if they say that, but whatever. That is kind of the idea behind this. So I'm going to stop there. And going to come back. We're going to come back later on this afternoon for this continue on the Baya Bhairava Sutta. And for those of you who want to stay behind because you want to have a chat about what happened yesterday, please do so. And for those of you who don't really want to be part of that, I would recommend that you just leave, go back to your room or whatever, and then we will take it from there. So have a nice lunch. Keep on enjoying yourself. We'll see you back in at 3:00 this afternoon.